Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
What up, y'all? This is Brett. Today is March 18th. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast 4.0. All right, fine. So we burned through that O song playlist a little more rapidly than I expected, and we've got a long way to go. It's only March here. I don't know how I'm going to stretch that gag out. I'm not sure really what to do. Anyway, very pleased to welcome Davi Barker back to the show. You remember Davi from such great episodes as The Dawn of Freedom, Parts 1 through 3, and Super Friends, and Middle Schoolers versus Zombies. He's back today to talk about the creative process from a new angle. I'll tell you the primary reason I had Davi on, even though the conversation expanded way beyond this, was to talk about creating with deadlines, creativity on command. Davi makes his living as a graphic designer. So there was some discussion in the group about optimal conditions for creativity. I suggested in a recent show that I don't work well with deadlines when it comes to being creative. Other people felt differently. So I thought I'd have Davi on to talk about that. But we spent a lot of time talking about freelance work, finding a creative zone, dealing with creativity blocks, maintaining motivation, and some of Davi's recent experiences as an art teacher in a private school. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you get some value out of it as well. Let's begin the show today with a couple of flashbacks from Porkfest, June 2015. Steve, we got any, like, flashback sound effects?
Bingo.
No, something more like a rewinding kind of sound. Sorry, everybody. Steve is a production intern. You know, like the tape sound going back? Yeah. Good enough.
How would you define freedom?
Freedom is the ability to affect change in reality through will.
What do you do for freedom as far as activism?
I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of graphics. I do a lot of thinking. Believe it or not, thinking is a big part of it because it's a constantly changing message. I converse with neighbors and friends and family. I support anyone whose work aligns with mine. I do what I can to collaborate with them and put in my two cents for advice. And I try to live as principled a life as I can.
Why do you attend Porkfest?
Because it's home.
How far did you travel?
From California.
By car or by plane?
By plane.
What's your favorite part of Porkfest?
The Freedom Fiends after show.
Well, let's not run out of steam now, gang. I mean, let's make this happen.
I'm trying to think of an arch nemesis to a panther.
Davi, what was when you were on my show last week? What was the superpower you said you wanted?
Okay, yeah. This is since I was a little boy, and people used to ask, like, what kind of superpower would you want? I said, I want the ability to conceptualize any paper product and draw it from my hand, like essentially print it from my hand as fast as I can draw, so I can produce any credential at any time. And it was for flyers or business cards or government documents or anything, any paper product or you know, whatever. That's right, exactly.
Like a human 3D printer.
Have you needed this?
I don't know.
Where have you thought about using it? Because you've thought about this.
Let's say you're doing street theater.
Yeah.
And you're talking to somebody, and you think to yourself, man, it'd be really cool if I had this whole backstory of this, like, organization, And you could just be like, hey, by the way, I'm from the Vikings for a Totalitarian America. Here's my business card. And it's official immediately, because why would you have a business card already if it didn't exist?
But, or like if you forgot your paperwork for some other...
It would be the ability to substantiate ramblings at a moment's notice.
How well would you have to know the detail of the thing?
It's just design. I design in my head.
Like a laser.
Okay, but...
No, it's not a laser printer, but we'll get to that.
But jumping off of what MK said about, like, you forgot your papers, right? So
yeah.
What if it's, like, your passport?
Oh,
you
yeah,
have to
like,
know
like permission slips for, like, every field trip in school? Done.
Yep, okay.
Permission slips.
All right.
That's what's up.
And he didn't know about Doctor Who. Do you
I didn't know about Doctor Who, who apparently has this
no.
power.
Oh, I know a little bit about Doctor Who.
No.
Doctor Who has something called psychic paper. And he just goes... I'm this guy.
That's right, yeah.
What? All of his papers just magically appear.
He's got like this little pad that he pulls out, right?
Uh-huh.
And he goes, I'm the, you know, some British thing. I'm the inspector, you know, whatever. And he's the inspector. He's got the person that he's showing it to sees what he wants them to see.
But that's a Jedi mind trick. Oh. Mine is not a Jedi mind trick. Mine is a printing process.
Yours is biological.
Mine is biological.
Yeah, right. So you're shedding...
Mine is a combination of chameleon cells, which can essentially all have like scales on my hand that are, you know, sub-optical. So you can't see them, but they're there. And that's like a dot matrix. And they're chameleon cells, so they can be any color. And then I shed them like snake skin in whatever shape that I want. So it's essentially like I'm going to like design in my head. I'm going to do the chameleon thing on my hand. And then it's going to shed. And there's a flyer or a business card or whatever made out of my skin and my ink.
I think this is genius.
I mean, this is way over.
Now, here's one.
Never let it be said that I underthought anything.
Right.
Now, here's one. What the one I like is being able to shrink or grow to any size. He asks if there's a limit to how big we can get. No. No. There's no limit.
No limit.
It wouldn't be a superpower.
Do you suffocate?
If there was a limit.
Yeah, what? I mean, your mass starts to attract planets at a certain point.
I had this problem with Futurama when Bender was shot into space and he just spun around forever and ever, and then there was like a colony growing on his chest and he kind of fostered it and became its evil tormenting god, and
right.
They started shooting rockets at each other. I was like, where's the gravitational field of this scenario? Like, I don't understand. Well, he's hollow, but also like if you really had a planet the shape of Bender, every time like an arm went out like this, there'd be like another gravitational pull from over here. So you couldn't, it isn't a sphere, right? It isn't as elegant as a planet. So I couldn't believe that these things were, you know, actually, unless they're like a moss and they're holding on themselves, but they weren't, they were bipedal. So like gravity doesn't work in this scenario. So this is my problem with your giganto guy is
girl.
It's a girl. No, Brett's a guy.
No, I'm a guy.
Yeah.
This right. is Brett. I don't know. Do we have a name for this thing, this person, this? What's Brett Vanat? But that's a secret identity, so don't tell anyone. What's the, like, what's the hero name?
Size King.
Size King. Mine was the pamphleteer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wait, for the...
That's my superpower, my chameleon snake power. I was called the pamphleteer.
And that's also the name of the superhero?
Yeah, that's the name of the superhero. I mean, this
Tax
would be a this would,
one episode.
This would be a very. I didn't even conceptualize myself as a hero. This is just what I wanted, right? Like, this is how I want to live my life.
Yeah, it's just like you're in line at the
reasonable
movies.
Reasonable expectations.
Like, I have tickets for this movie.
Exactly.
Fuck the world.
You're not trying to save any lives or like turn back time or anything like that.
Well,
you're
know,
like, no, I just want some
like,
movie tickets every
You know
now
what
then.
It would be? It's that I'd be like, hey, I have a ticket to the movie and I get in and then like my uncle is killed by the movie or something and then I feel this and then I feel a shooter, right? A theater shooter, and then my uncle dies and I'm like, oh my God, if I hadn't used my power to get my uncle into this movie illegally, he'd still be alive. Now I must use my powers for good.
There you go. Or things get so bad because you're so lazy and everybody's like, where is the pamphleteer? And you're just at the bank going, I'd like to deposit $100. I'd like to deposit $100.
I had not even conceived of shedding money.
Davi, welcome back to School Sucks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You know, you came up in my Facebook notifications today because it was a year ago on this very day that I posted a episode from Liberty Forum, and the title of that episode was Davi Barker, Middle Schoolers versus Zombies. So, that was a great
Happy
conversation.
Anniversary, Brett.
You said at the beginning, or I used it in the intro to the show, you think the current fascination with zombies, this was a year ago, everybody, has to do with people's fear that the democratic process is failing them. You, right. sir, are a visionary.
Well, yeah, the current state of the democratic process certainly validates some of that theory.
Are you paying close attention to what's happening out there?
No, I try not to pay close attention to it because I absorb more than I want just being in America. So I don't pay very close attention to it, but I do pick up a lot of it incidentally. And the interesting thing, something interesting going on right now is, like, if you go back to the 2000 election with George W. Bush, America suddenly learned, because a lot of us weren't paying attention, that presidents aren't elected by popular vote and that the popular vote doesn't really matter. There's this electoral college thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this conflict between the popular vote and the process. And now, you know, years later, we're seeing this in the parties, that this discrepancy between the popular vote and the decision makers is now taking place in the primary process. And people are saying, like, yeah, we want to hold up the convention and make sure that the popular candidate doesn't actually get the nomination.
With super delegates.
With super delegates, which are just the electoral college of the parties. And so this conflict between establishment and populace is trickling all the way down into the very beginning of the system. And it's just going to get worse.
Well, that's dark. But, you know, you did say, I think you went on to say that zombies are interesting because they're this majoritarian monster. That was the description that you used. It's interesting. And I was thinking about it because, you know, I go to Facebook or I turn on the news sometimes. I'm like, I don't feel right. Something is scaring me. I don't know what it is. And it's interesting because it's not Trump. It's Hillary a little bit, and it's, you know, but it doesn't feel like it's Trump or Bernie Sanders themselves that are scaring me. It's the crowds. You're absolutely right. So that's why it's, you know, even though I don't see, okay, fine. I'm trying to say no, no.
Like, we're trying to avoid the pejorative, right? But like, but it is the mob. It is the crowd, and it's how fickle the crowd is. Like at least with a candidate, we know they're going to change some of their positions, but they're going to be relatively the same person throughout their political career. Whereas the mob seems to like grab a hold of whatever the flavor of the month is, and mm-hmm. that's what they're murderously passionate about.
Yes, indeed. You know, the other thing about this too, I feel very hyper-stimulated. This is something we're gonna talk about in the show today. And so many ideas are coming to me that I want to like cash in on as they're current, as I can make some hay with them. But things are just happening too fast, I feel, almost for me to develop things. You know, like, sure. I keep thinking of all these Trump-centric videos that I want to make. And by the time I start to, you know, capture, like, okay, here's the source video. This is what inspired me. And then I start to kind of create a narrative to go with that. He's already done something that's made that last thing not newsworthy anymore. Yeah. And, you know, that phenomenon, the speed in which we have to create is one of the reasons why I wanted to include you in this creative pursuit series that we're doing this March. But before we get into creativity, or the creativity on command, I guess is what I would call it, I want to talk a little bit about your background for people who are unfamiliar with your work. You've been on the show before, so I'll connect people through the show notes to your archives. You are primarily an author and an artist. And sure. The last time you were on the show, the reason why we were talking about zombies is you were writing a series of books called Survivor Max, which right. was about a young boy who's living through a zombie apocalypse, and he's basically armed primarily with his own resourcefulness, right? We talked about there are no guns, so guns are not an option on the table for dealing with the zombies. You said that that was something that made them look not menacing enough in the story. So I really like that. But Survivor Max was a series of books, correct?
So yeah, the first book is Max by himself getting by on his resourcefulness. And it happens that he is from a gated community that banned firearms, even though New Hampshire generally allows firearms. And so for the first part of the outbreak, he doesn't have access to firearms. And that's the whole first book. Since then, the second book has come out where he is brought into a refugee center that's been built at his middle school. And so they have an armory and they have sort of guarded centurions on top of the school and things like that. So there's a little bit more involved with firearms. But in that book, it's much more about the social conflict inside the I almost said prison, but camp.
Right, right.
And now the third book, which is the one I'm working on now, I'm hoping to have it done by October, is about the interplay between different survivor groups, right? So we go from the individual to the individual surviving inside of the commune to now how do these communes that are now in communication communicate and build trade routes or raids, or how do the group dynamics occur?
So is it a more positive spin, or a more, I guess not positive spin, but a more optimistic assessment of what kind of society would unfold than, say, maybe The Walking Dead is, which is more conflict-based from what I understand? I don't know. I don't watch the show, but that's what I've picked up, that what drives the show is not so much the people's relationship or avoidance of the walkers, it's their conflicts with each other.
Yeah, I would say that's a huge theme in The Walking Dead. The TV show, where it is now, if it continues to follow the track of the comic book, it's about to get into the idea of multiple survivor compounds and allegiances between survivor compounds and friends and enemies and stuff like that. So it's branching into this theme too of what the larger world looks like if they follow the comic, and it seems like they are. But to me, that's the most interesting. And it's funny, I don't know if I've ever told you this before, but you have a video, I don't remember the title of it, but it's sort of tongue in cheek about how terrible libertarianism would be.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know this video?
Why libertarianism is so dangerous.
Right. So that's essentially my model for the society in the zombie apocalypse. I'm going to try and follow those steps that you've outlined about the growth of a new government.
Oh, no. Interesting. Right. I'm happy to hear that. You know, that actually leads me to my next question, because as you're writing this trilogy, and this is a process that has taken place over a number of years, did you have like the whole story formulated before you typed the first chapter of the first book? Or do you find yourself, and I guess the answer could be both, do you find yourself kind of reacting to things that are happening in the world now and maybe incorporating some of those reactions into the story?
So the long plot of the first trilogy I had formulated in my mind before I started.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm constantly problem solving. I'm constantly running into situations where I don't quite know what's physically possible. I don't quite know what's thematically appropriate. And so the details get massaged along the way. But now that I'm coming up to being almost finished with the trilogy itself, I now have an outline in my head for like 9 books.
Mm-hmm.
that I'm, I don't know if I'm going to get right to it, but I'm going to get to it eventually. And so I'm constantly working at both ends of that spectrum, right? Like some things are these long form storylines that go on for a long time and they're premeditated. And then there's others where even while I'm in the moment writing on the page, I have to solve a problem, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times those little solutions, I know that they're right, or at least I choose them when they weave most elegantly into the longer plot.
If I remember correctly, you said something, this is another thing I was interested in exploring with you, that you're basically creating problems for yourself to solve as a writer, as a kind of motivation.
Yeah, it's been an excuse to learn a lot of things that I didn't know about before. Like I wrote an entire chapter on smoking meat, which I didn't know how to do.
Right.
And so I had to look into it because I wanted the chapter to serve at least as a basic primer for the reader on how to do that.
Yeah, I remember talking before too, and interesting, this is an interesting contrast to what we're talking about, but originally you were planning on writing a very different series of books, right? About people coming from outer space.
Oh, the alien one.
Yeah, and you wound up abandoning that. Why? Or putting it on hold.
It's on hold. I mean, I guess ironically, because it required too much research.
Yeah.
In that one, I found that I couldn't push the plot forward without doing tremendous amounts of research. Whereas with this story, because I know the characters and I know the geography and I know the culture and I know the monster so well, I sort of get to decide what I need to research and focus on it maybe once or twice or three times in a book. But for the most part, it's a free write. Whereas before, every chapter required research on, you know, the culture in China and the culture in Somalia, and because it was a global epic, right?
Oh, that sounds like a tremendous undertaking.
I'll get to it eventually.
You can probably outsource some of that too, you know?
Yeah, I want to explore this idea of outsourcing really anything creative.
Like
this has been sort of a theme for me in my thinking as an artist and as an agorist for the last few years, is it seems like most creative people have a very DIY attitude. And they want it all to be perfect because they have a vision, and so they feel they have to do it themselves, right? But as economists in the liberty movement, the division of labor is incredibly important to productivity, and you actually produce more if you can collaborate than you can individually if you work separately, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think collaboration is a huge part of the creative process, especially in a community like ours. You know, but you're absolutely right. The impulse is to go it alone. And I mean, you know, even in creating a show like this, which is certainly not nearly as imaginative as making a film or writing a book, I sometimes hesitate asking like people in the audience for advice or for suggestions, or even like, what questions would you like me to ask a guest? You know, mm-hmm. I do it sometimes, but other times I'm thinking like, maybe I just would just like to really surprise people. So yeah, there is a real impulse to go it alone, to have like complete Stanley Kubrick style authorship over whatever you're doing. And yeah. I only have a glimpse of that because I've only taken my creative pursuit so far. But it's interesting. I was just talking to our friend Nick Hazelton, and he was asking me about inspiration, and it almost always comes from, for me anyway, admiration of what somebody else has done, right? There isn't like this first movement of creativity that just appears fully in my mind. It's always me responding to something that I saw somebody else do. Or I even explained it to Nick as like a combination of, you know, something that maybe like a video that somebody else produced with a piece of music that I happened to be listening to at the time that I encountered that video. Have you ever heard of a movie called Samsara?
No.
It's this fascinating documentary. They shot it in like over 100 countries, I think over a period of 5 years. No dialogue in it. It's just all these different visual stories. If you've ever seen, it showed up in a bunch of different videos, this clip of like this sweeping thing. It's like factory farming, and it shows like this sweeping device picking up chickens and shooting them down a tube. And then like it cuts to like people in the supermarket in like a time lapse, and then ultimately to people sitting in a fast food restaurant and eating. It's a fairly, I would say, overused piece of footage on YouTube. I know because I've used it myself, but that came from Samsara. This scene where these guys do like this techno dance in a prison, like in this prison yard somewhere in the Far East, there's all of these inmates and they get into formation and they just start dancing to techno music in the middle of the prison as it's part of their routine. So anyway, Samsara is this fascinating documentary that spans the world. And it just has these incredible visuals in it. And I was telling Nick this story about how sometimes it's interesting to just take, you know, what somebody else saw through the camera's eye and juxtaposing it with like some kind of music that has my interest at a given time.
Oh, yeah. It's like collage work.
Collage work. Like, exactly.
Like you pull an image from one place and a headline from another place and you put them together and suddenly they both have completely different meanings than in their original context.
Yeah. And you've done exactly that kind of work. People can see it on your website. You call it, I forget what you call it, something collage.
Enhanced collage.
Enhanced collage. So what is enhanced collage and where did that come from?
I first started doing collage work while I was studying William S. Burroughs and his cut-up technique.
Mm-hmm.
And what William S. Burroughs did was he would take a body of text, he would cut it into strips, and then lay it out so that all of the grammar and syntax was broken. And then he would retype it. And so he would give you this short story where none of the grammar made any sense. None of the pronouns were in the right place. Everything was broken and disjointed, but you could still kind of make out the themes of the story and maybe a little bit of what happened. And you get this real psychedelic sense of what the original was, right?
Yeah. What would he want people to do with that? I don't know if you ever heard him talk about why he did it. How would he expect people to respond to it?
I don't quite remember all the details of what his reasoning was. I remember some of the interesting things that I read. Like he said that it forced him to confront his own latent homosexuality because he would write an erotic story and then the genders of the characters would change when he cut it up. And he found himself still titillated by it and things like this.
Why? And you started doing it out of that inspiration, or were you trying to communicate a clear message? Because I've looked at a few of them and they are chaotic.
Yeah. So I was trying to bring this attitude of Burroughs and text to imagery and media. And I was trying to say, like, what if instead of doing this with just a page of words, what if we did this with buckets of pictures? And I started going through magazines and newspapers and everything and cutting them and sort of categorizing them. Like, I wanted to have categories in each piece. But when it came time to assemble, I was like pulling pictures sort of randomly out of buckets and taping them up on the canvas in a way that seemed to fit compositionally. But I was trying not to have a lot of conscious message projection, but you can't avoid it. And then I would start with that raw collage, which was almost completely chaotic, but then I'd scan it into the computer and I would tweak a few things and Photoshop a few things and maybe change the headlines a little bit and try to sort of, at that point, push the theme that seemed to emerge from the raw collage.
Interesting. So the theme, you would feel like the theme a lot of the time would just sort of emerge on its own?
Yeah. And the other thing is people would look at them and assume that I had an intent and that it was completely different than anything that I saw in the painting or in the collage, right? So, like, they would look at it and they'd be, like, upset because I insulted some sacred cow of theirs that I didn't even realize was in the collage. Now, you got to understand, too, that this entire project is a collaborative work. At the time, or at least in the process of putting this together, I was in a group called the Order of the Blue Tape, or OBT. Blue tape is that painter's tape that you use to – it's, like, removable – painter's tape.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so there were a lot of collage artists working together. Sometimes we would swap pieces mid-project. We got in the habit of working with other collage artists around the country and cutting people's shipping addresses into a work of art and then shipping it to them so that you had this weird vortex of newsprint around the country of people working on each other's collages.
I'm stuck on this one with it's the Bushes, Obama, and Clinton. And they all have multiple eyes and mouths.
Yeah. I forget what that one is called. It's sort of about how they all lie. The soldier takes up like the dominant part of the image, right? It's almost like the full, I think he's on the right-hand side.
Yep.
And he's the person who's like putting himself in harm's way. And he's the hero of American culture. And we're supposed to celebrate them and thank them for their service, right? But then behind them is this sort of line of executives. And every single one of them fought a war and every single one of them lies to get it into war. And these lies are known. This is not conspiracy. Like we know now things were not true that started these wars, that triggered these wars. And so there's sort of like secret chiefs behind this soldier, if that makes sense.
Indeed. Now, where would you ultimately present these if there was like a consistent place where they would wind up?
Well, I've done gallery shows with them. This is what the Order of the Blue Tape was about. The reason that we used blue tape was because it was removable. And so what we would do is we would print out hundreds of them or maybe take them to Kinko's and do black and white and do more. And then we would tape them around town with blue tape so that it's like graffiti, but you're not ever damaging property. People can rip them down without harming anything. But it makes them like ubiquitous in a downtown district, right?
Yeah. Would you ever, as a follow-up, observe people reacting to them? Like blue tape one up and then go and duck around the corner?
Yeah, I've done that. I've also gotten direct feedback from people in galleries that just come up to me and sort of have thoughts on particular pieces or whatever. Most people find them abrasive, I think. I think people don't like being confused, and the first reaction is confusion.
Indeed, yeah.
Because there's no coherent narrative, and so they have to look for one, and ultimately they have to project one.
Yeah, that was certainly my experience. I looked at a few earlier today. And they are confronting and, at first glance, confusing. Whoa. I'm sorry if I sound distracted. I'm kind of scrolling through them as we talk. If you're listening to the audio version of the show, please check the show notes to have a look at what we're talking about. So anyway, we could go through all of these and I could get very hung up here, but I wanted to talk about the work you do a lot of the time to get paid, which is graphic design, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although I've gotten paid for some of these too. Some of these have sold as prints or canvases or things like that.
But
everything's for sale.
Well, you've done the work that you've done for income includes graphic design project and shiny badges, right?
Right.
Okay. So a lot of the graphic design stuff, I assume you have to work on often stricter deadlines than you would creating other types of art or even writing your own books. And the reason why I wanted to discuss this with you, in recent shows, I talked about hamstringing myself with the way I've set things up in 2016 by having theme months, which means that, you know, I have to finish the theme within 30 days. And I found that, you know, really being able to focus in on creating the, you know, most insightful or creative project, like that's kind of the casualty. Creativity is the casualty, for me anyway, of working on a deadline.
Sure.
And I'm interested in maybe hearing some of your ideas for how to overcome that. Some people have said, I create fantastically when deadlines are imposed, external deadlines are imposed. I can understand how people could be highly productive with deadlines. I think deadlines are great for productivity as far as actually just taking a project from start to finish. But for me, I don't think that I have the best opportunities to explore the potential of something when I'm working within a very narrow time frame. So some follow-up questions to that would be like, what do you do to get into that kind of creative zone when you know you only have a very limited time to execute?
I don't aim for perfection. My first draft to most clients are rough sketches of color and composition based on whatever their theme is, right? So I do a lot of events, right? Benefit dinners or speakers tours or things like that, where they want a theme for the whole event. And so my first draft is sort of raw, uncoordinated, and imperfect, but it gives me a sense from the client of which aesthetic they're leaning toward so that I know where to put the energy when it comes time to polish.
Do you find that there are certain types of graphic design work that are consistently trickier than others? An example would be maybe logos. I imagine logos being just terribly difficult because there's so much at stake in designing a logo for somebody versus maybe just producing artwork for a specific event.
You know, maybe this is the privilege of freelance work, but I find if I don't care about the project at all, I find it very difficult to be motivated. So if I have like a straight commercial client who is selling hairspray, and I have no investment in it other than it being a paying gig, it can be difficult for me to come up with something creative or innovative mm-hmm. about hairspray. But what I would do in that sort of a situation is that I would survey the market and I would say, well, how are other hairspray companies advertising? What colors are common? What shapes are common? What does it seem like the target audience is? And I'll make an amalgam, right? Whereas if I have a client who is involved in something that I care about, then it sort of becomes a shared vision. And I just, for some reason, there's a lot more creativity and innovation that flows into that kind of project.
Absolutely. So the work you've done in the Liberty space is probably a great example of that.
Sure.
Absolutely. Have you ever gotten like really, really stuck with some kind of project where you didn't know how to go forward, or you couldn't connect on a vision, even if it was, you know, in an area where you thought you should be able to connect with the client fairly easily?
Yeah. So this is part of going freelance and why I had to. Before I went full-time freelance, I worked for a screen printing company in their art department, setting up screens for a variety of clients, like everything from exterminators to police departments.
Mm-hmm.
And, because of the sort of the nature of the regulations, it's funny I could go into like why this actually happens, but there's actually a regulatory pressure to take more municipal clients as opposed to private sector clients. Because the regulations make it more expensive and they affect my way, who, whatever, it's a long story. But anyway, so it meant that I had a lot of jobs and a lot of clients that were things like rec t-shirts for fire departments or school uniforms for high schools or acrylic awards for police officers or things like that. And some of those are so repetitive because it's like every year there's a new rec shirt from that department. Or maybe you've done 12 this season because every department has a baseball team or whatever. And it's like, one, I'm not terribly interested in sports, but I'm especially not interested in police departments mm-hmm. or public schools or any of these things. And so it's like it's trudging forward creatively when it is both monotonous because you're doing the same thing over and over again, but has to be sufficiently different from last year's. Mm-hmm. But also clients I don't want. That I found tedious.
How long did this go on for?
I worked there about 5 years.
Did you ever try to develop? I mean, I completely sympathize, and I've certainly been in those situations where it's like, there's just no way forward with this. This is not interesting or exciting, and doing this work actually kind of feels like more of a drag, though I'm getting paid for it. I've certainly been in that boat before. Did you ever try any strategies for keeping yourself motivated or interested in that work?
I picture
you. Yeah, see, that was it. That was what I was hoping you would say. Because I just picture you from knowing you, like, am I questioning his professionalism if I say, how come you never tried to slip anything in there? But have at it.
Absolutely. There was more than one. There were two schools whose colors were black and gold. Mm-hmm. And so I just loved that. I put ANCAP stuff all over the place. and so, like, they would do, like, a flag for their rally, right?
Mm-hmm.
and I would start with the black and gold ANCAP thing, and then I'd put their mascot was the bulldog. I'd put the bulldog on the middle, and then I would come up with an excuse to make the slogan 3A word so I could put the A3 on there.
Yeah. Like,
so there's things like that where that keeps me entertained. And then others were on a number of like police officers awards and things. I'd put little anarchy signs on their badges, or I'd put their badge upside down, or I'd find other ways to make it fun for me.
How would you slip in an anarchy sign and not have that in the review process be discussed?
Well, it's very small,
mm-hmm.
and most people don't look very closely at the proof. And A is already a very natural form. It's like three of the five lines of a star. And so if there was a star on the badge already, it's very simple to sort of just take off two of those arms and tweak it a little bit. And from far away, it looks correct, right?
Yeah. But even with those fun aspects of what was often mundane work, eventually you said, there's another direction I can go. And was it when you started to realize what was maybe available to you by connecting with like the FSP, or how did that realization happen? When you said, I'm leaving this command kind of graphic design work where I take clients I don't want and I become a freelancer, how did that happen for you?
So I started doing freelance work on the side for supplemental income, and that included Free State Project work, and that included like working with Tim Fry from Roberts & Roberts or Drew Phillips when he was doing Don't Tread on Meme and the Dime Cards, like those sorts of jobs. The most stable work I got at that time was as a marketing person for the Silver Circle movie. Mm-hmm. Which was sort of regular part-time graphic work. And I had this idea, and it was intentional, that I was going to begin to supplement my primary income until I could transition fully to freelance work. This was my goal. But I also got laid off. So like, it's not like I decided when I was going to leave. I decided I intended to leave, but they decided when I actually left. Right.
How long was the overlap?
Oh, I don't know. I probably would have been out in another 6 months or a year, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Who was the first freelance client, if it's okay to talk about, like Liberty client that you approached? Or even one of the first. One of the first would be fine, because I'm kind of interested in, you know, just making your experience useful for people in my audience, how you sold yourself to...
I do know. It was Hijinks Comics. It wasn't a Liberty client. It was a comic book store. And I was doing a student magazine at the time, producing it myself with a small crew, maybe three or four people. We were trying to figure out how to make it like revenue neutral. And so we were trying to sell advertisements in the magazine to sort of supplement the printing, right? And so at first we just created fictional advertisements, right? And we like built the classifieds with fake ads and whatever. And that way it just sort of looked like maybe there was a successful ad venue here and maybe somebody would take us up on buying it. But then we started going around and giving the magazine to local businesses to say, here, would you put this out for us? And then if you're interested, you can advertise this way. And we would sort of pitch them on the price to supplement printing and things like that.
Yeah.
And Hijinks Comics did two things. One, the owner really liked the painting that had been one of the covers. And so he bought the painting from me, the original.
Oh, nice.
And then also he needed flyers. And so he wasn't really interested in advertising with us, but he was interested in hiring me as a graphic designer to design this flyer for him. Right?
Yeah.
Because he had seen the art in the magazine, which was all mine, or mostly mine. So that was my first, like, other than my dad, like for my dad's a graphic designer too. And so I used to do sort of, what do they call that? Overflow work for him.
Right. As you started to connect with people, maybe more out my way, was there like anyone that you identified as like a really desirable client that you wanted to work with and then went through some process of pursuit to land freelance work with them?
I mean, Tim Fry, I would say probably Roberts and Roberts. It wasn't like Hunter and Prey or anything.
Right. Right.
But, yeah, I've gotten to know Tim really well over the years, and I've gone from sort of working not just on his professional graphic design, like his business cards and things like that, but also any sort of project that he ends up a sponsor on, I sort of go along as the artist.
Oh, very cool.
I sort of get pushed around by Tim, right, into other projects, which is fun. I guess Mark Warden was probably one of my earliest clients in New Hampshire. It was his campaign materials. I did some like door hangers and things like that. And, you know, it's interesting. Shiny Badges is a venue to pursue a client, right?
Because, yeah, yeah.
Because I'd think to myself, I'd look at the movement and I'd say, what do they need? And I'd say, they need a Cop Block badge. Well, I'm not from Cop Block. I never like was part of their mission or anything. I do video police on my own, you know, yeah, as an independent contractor or whatever.
Yeah.
But so I approached them and I said, hey, I want to do this badge. I'm going to do the art and I'm going to pay for it and whatever, but I can sell them to you and you can resell them for profit and I'll give you a cut and we'll make it this collaboration. And as a result of all of that groundwork, I have their logo all vectorized and ready for anything. And I have advertisements I've made for the badge that fit perfectly for advertisements for other things for them. So I ended up working on their door hanger, or I ended up working on other things not related to the Shiny Badges product, but because I sort of stepped forward with art already in my portfolio appropriate to the client, sometimes I get picked up for other things.
And Shiny Badges went in a lot of different directions after Cop Block. And that was the reason why I started down this line of questioning, is that if somebody in my audience, like so many people in my audience have, attended Porkfest, attended Liberty Forum, maybe even Libertopia, the one they do out west, they've seen your stuff.
Yeah.
Without knowing that it was your stuff.
And I start seeing it on people at events that I didn't buy, that I didn't sell it to them. I didn't do Liberty Forum this year. I did the Students for Liberty convention or conference in Washington, D.C. instead. And that was because I wanted to get out into a new market. Right.
Yeah,
like everybody,
sure,
at Liberty Forum has bought everything from me that they really want. So unless,
right,
unless there's a new product, there's not a lot to sell there. So, but there were people there who were already wearing my pins, like when I got there. So, yeah, it's permeated.
Yeah, absolutely. So we veered off a little bit, and I just want to return to maybe some practical advice about that creative zone or dealing with creativity blocks. I'm sure you've encountered tight deadlines or times where, you know, I said that one of the explorations I wanted to do this month was this fear I have that I'm out of new ideas. You know, so let's start with, you know, finding the conditions to do creative work. Do you have any kind of a routine or a setting that you prefer? Or do you find that it's more like not sitting down and trying to do something? The best ideas or the best visions kind of come to you when you're least expecting it, after maybe you've examined a problem, but then it's kind of gone into a period of incubation where you're not thinking about it so regularly, and then the solution just kind of springs forth. Or you know, the reason why I wanted to talk to you about this is I picture there's a lot of times where you actually have to sit down and create something like pretty much on the spot. So I'm interested in what kind of a routine or a process you have for that.
So for personal things that are not deadline oriented, I'm just trying to have fun. Mm-hmm. And I've found that playing in public generates more work than playing in private. And so I'll have a funny idea and I'll sketch it out and I'll put it on Facebook, or maybe I'll make some graphics, or if it's particularly entertaining, maybe I'll make a Facebook group about it or whatever. And it just sort of, it's, I play until it stops being fun. And then there's this thing that exists out there as a sort of portfolio about that. And some people see the play and say, hey, let's make that into work. And, mm-hmm. and it becomes paid work or inspires paid work. Another thing, and this is maybe a little nefarious, but libertarians have a lot of really great ideas when they're all hanging out, being drunk and high. Yep. And I'm a teetotaler. So I'm sitting in these circles of libertarians, and I'm the only person who's going to remember these things the next morning.
Right,
and,
right.
And so I hunt and gather for inspiration at Liberty Forum, at Porkfest, at places like that. And it's not like I steal these ideas. Like, I bring them back to the people who I had them with around the campfire, and I see if they want to collaborate on it and things like that. But being the sober one in the room means that a lot of ideas that would have been lost maybe aren't.
I think there's a kind of a contagious effect that can happen when those types of people are together, too. You mentioned before we started recording today that you recently re-listened to easily one of my favorite audios of all time that I've ever been a part of, what we did at Porkfest last year. We called The Dawn of Freedom.
Yeah.
And it was, we did an episode of The Freedom Fiends. There were quite a few people on mic. And then afterwards, we did an after show from 3:30 in the morning until 8 a.m. until people made us stop. And yeah. I think all of us were sober during that. There were four primary people involved and then a studio audience, some of whom stuck with us until 8 o'clock in the morning. And things were kind of maybe tight at first, and it felt very much like a show, but then it just expanded and transformed into this very magical experience where people were just kind of feeding off each other. And it was almost like, when I listened back to it, when I was editing it, it was almost like parts of it were rehearsed, like skits.
Yeah.
Like the timing of a joke was just so perfect, or something like that. But it was all just completely off the cuff, unplanned. I remember like a half hour into the recording, I was like, oh, well, let's not run out of steam here.
There are a few places where you're like, are we done? Is that it?
But it was like a half hour into it. It was like a half hour into it where I was like, oh, I think we might be out of steam. But no, we went on for four more hours, and I think it just got more interesting as it went. So that social dynamic is super, super important.
And there's a lot of great ideas in that show
mm-hmm.
that I'm glad there's a recording of it, because we'll probably end up going back and revisiting those ideas eventually.
There was a lot of great ideas. There was a lot of bad ideas, like my dating site. And I think that's part of the process.
You don't like the dating site?
I'm over. I think that was more of an impulse. But that's part of the process. And there was a freedom in that experience with you, me, MK, and Derek, and the audience who was with us most of the time as well, to just throw things out. I'm going to say this because I think it will sound stupid when I say it. And maybe it's the seed of a good idea, and maybe it's not. But yeah, there probably is a lot of seed idea gold in that discussion, for sure.
Well, that's a lot of that. That's kind of what Cut Up is about, too. Like, the chaos of a group of people just running their mouths without the censors, without the critics, and allowing this sort of tapestry of nonsense. Then it becomes about the discerning eye who says, that was the seed and that was the manure.
Yeah. Right.
And so you can do that in a group, and it's great in a group because then you've already sort of, you've begun the process of your collaborative creative team, but you can also simulate that with Cut Up, because there are things that are going to pop out at you from the chaos of this image soup or the chaos of this text quilt.
Right.
That things get put together in random ways, and it becomes not that necessarily that you put those together for any reason, it's chaos, but your discerning eye will still pick out the things that come together in really creative ways. It's especially good at like juxtaposing interesting words that you wouldn't have put together otherwise, but become meaningful.
Well, I think there's turning that eye on more of the time is a really important thing to develop, a kind of awareness to develop. Because I think we all know, like, we could have had that same conversation. One of the reasons that was so magical about that social gathering that we just happened to record at Porkfest, we could have had that same conversation unrecorded and people would have said, oh, we should have recorded that. Like I've said probably 10,000 times about conversations that I've had in life. But once the recording goes on, what usually happens is that there's this pressure to create. And some of the most interesting and inspiring, potentially like enriching and seed planting moments happen when you're not expecting them, right? It's probably the same at these events as it is in what you described in cut up or collage making. There, it's kind of synonymous, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So being able to just turn on your awareness and maybe not like always saying, hey, everybody, I'm trying to, you know, because you don't do that, right? When you go around at these events in this observational way, you're not like, hey, everybody, I'm fishing for ideas. So, you know, let's be on your toes and, you know, think creatively and think outside. Yeah, right. That doesn't happen. You've just managed to kind of turn up your awareness in certain situations, which is really, really interesting. Because I think a lot of things pass us by just because we compartmentalize, you know, leisure or social activities from creative work. And maybe like there can be some inspiration that bleeds into creative work, but we're probably missing a lot because we just don't have that awareness that a lot of opportunities are going to exist in this setting or in this activity that could really be turned into something more.
You know, it's a little bit like distillation.
Mm-hmm.
Like this happens on the Freedom Fiends a lot. Like I'm sure this has happened to you on the Freedom Fiends too, that the conversation is jovial and it has that quality of being off the cuff and kind of chaotic and spontaneous. But then somebody says something and all of the Freedom Fiends hosts are sort of calibrated now to say that phrase belongs on a bumper sticker. Right. Like, and we've all like got our ears tuned to like what sounds good for a meme. Right.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, manure and seed was good, but it's a distillation process. It's about cutting away the noise and leaving the gold, I guess.
The impact. What has the impact? Because it takes a lot of that noise to get to that one, you know, part of it that really hits. You know, you have to make a lot of noise too. I think that's true in so many areas.
I guess that's the reason when I was talking about clients and doing rough sketches before I invested in any particular design, it's because I have to make a lot of noise before I see what resonates with them, right? And so I guess I'd say to anybody in any creative pursuit is don't be afraid to make noise.
Mm-hmm.
That sitting there and scribbling on your canvas is more productive than sitting there and staring at your canvas, right?
Yeah, you know, for me, what's coming to mind is like, I think I compared the Freedom Fiends one time to a baseball game where, you know, a baseball game is long and there's a lot of a downtime in a baseball game. There's a lot of absence of action, right? But you're there for the experience of it. And then maybe in a 3-hour game, there's like 15 minutes of action. Well, the Freedom Fiends was this kind of open forum, which is very relaxed. When you're doing the show, you don't feel like you're on dozens of radio stations, you know, right. It just doesn't have that kind of feel to it, which makes it like, what did Michael Dean say? We're too busy talking to do talk radio.
Yeah. I think that was mine originally.
Yeah. But... yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's a great line. And that really captures what that show is about. But, you know, in the baseball game metaphor, it's not like there's nothing happening in a baseball game, but everybody is perfectly happy being there for a long time to just see very, very few impactful things. And that's kind of the process. I think there's a lot of shows like that, but it's entirely worth it.
You know, this is sounding like a Skinner box all of a sudden.
Oh, no. How so?
Well, I mean, like, it's not like there's a Skinner in this Skinner box, but it is how much noise, what is the ratio of noise to reward? That's how you create the reward, is you have to, wow, it's funny because the Skinner box is programmed. It's designed to have that ratio perfect so that you keep making noise.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem like it's a similar impulse. Like maybe it's that impulse in a natural environment.
But the incentive is to make the noise, right?
You're making noise and you're hoping to strike gold.
Yeah.
And for some people, it doesn't happen often enough to keep making noise, either because they're dissatisfied with the noise they created and they're critical of themselves, or because the ratio is too much and they feel like it's too much work to create gold, or because they're not very discerning and can't tell the difference between noise and gold.
Or it could just be an attitude thing. It could be failure. Like, noise without gold is failure.
Yeah.
So why make a bunch of noise to experience all this failure when I can just make no noise and not experience any failure? Like, that would be preferable to a lot of people who have a real aversion to failure. So I think that that attitude would be a real creative hindrance. And I think we see plenty of that. I think that, you know, school or most people's, you know, introduction to the work world would certainly contribute to that. You're not here to, like, try things out and see how they work. You know, you're here to accept assignments and execute them according to these instructions, and then make sure that you get this level of satisfaction from some kind of authority figure. So most people, I think, are just, a lot of people anyway, would just be really uncomfortable in a creative space like that, where it's like, make noise and see what happens. I talked in an earlier show about trying to run a classroom like that. Like, I would teach algebra and it just sucked. Because I'd, you know, try to involve the class and ask them questions that were all this very much a convergent type of thinking, right? Like, there is a right answer to this question, and you either know it or you don't, and how embarrassing if you don't know it. And I would just open up the class with these kind of, you know, divergent thinking activities, where we would try to solve problems with ridiculous solutions and, you know, make up words. And that was a much better kind of environment. It built confidence over useless math knowledge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a willingness to take risks. I don't really think, I always tell the stories about my past as if I was some kind of visionary. Like, I don't think I knew why I was doing it, but it just felt right. It felt better. It was like a nicer setting for me to be in as the supposed authority figure than to just do drill and kill math work with these kids. So that's why I did it at the time. And maybe I found some other meaning for it later.
I mean, I do this a little bit as an art teacher. I find that a lot of students, if they can't do it perfect the first time, they don't want to do it at all. And there's no such thing as doing it perfect the first time, because everything's going to take practice, or you've got to produce a lot of noise before you create something you're proud of in an art class. So a lot of them get hung up or paralyzed right at the beginning of a project. And so one of the things that I started doing was when a kid said, I can't do this, I don't know how, I'm no good at art. My reaction was, well, that's perfect, because the assignment, see, on this project is to do it badly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The assignment is to do bad art. Do you give me the most awful interpretation of these instructions that you can give me?
Right, right.
And then they smile and laugh, and it becomes fun, and the pressure of producing quality is gone, and it becomes just about play.
And that is so super important. And I think that that's a great way to alleviate those concerns that people have. I mean, if they're in a school, even if it's a, you know, a fairly alternative school, the rest of the school process works a certain way, right?
Yeah. And even though it's a private school, it feels like a public school as far as the academic portions, for sure.
And the creative process is kind of alien considering the way the rest of school works. So anytime you can create a break in that, as, you know, a leader or a mentor or even a teacher, is really great. And did you find that over time that that was able to build more engagement with students, like creating an environment where failure is okay? No, even failure is what was assigned, that they can move beyond that failure, that they weren't so judgmental about it?
Yeah, so one of the things that I taught, not in all of the classes, but in some of them, was I turned art into an acronym. And I wrote it up on the board, and I wrote applied rule transgression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, I'm going to come at you with some instructions and some rules for this class. But if you've got not just breaking the rules for its own sake, but if you understand the technique I'm teaching and you want to break it on purpose for a reason, it's applied rule transgression, right? And so you give them the freedom to do it their own way, to scribble outside of the lines. A lot of the times a student will really like a technique we learned one day, and the class will move forward and work on something else. And I'll let him continue working on that technique so that he can get good at it as much as he feels like he needs to explore it, right? So he gets credit for these other things that he's not even going to look at because he's busy with the thing that caught his attention, right?
Yeah, that's terrific.
And so there's things like that where it's malleable, it's not structured as rigidly, it allows them to engage more.
Well said. So let's change directions, and I just want to ask you a couple of closing questions that I want to put to as many people as possible in this series. Can you think of, is there anything else at the front of your mind that is really a powerful source of inspiration for you in what you do?
Yeah, there's another book that I've been meaning to reread, and I read this, I think I must have got it for like my 13th birthday or something like that, and it was called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameroon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a textbook, but it's also kind of a self-help book. And so like it's about fostering personal creativity in whatever field that you want that to be in. And it's about the common sort of psychological, spiritual, emotional hangups that people have in allowing themselves to be creative. And so in that sense, it's a self-help book in that it's asking you to look at yourself emotionally and analyze yourself and what your hangups are and to sort of go to battle with your critic and things like that. But it's also a textbook in the sense that each chapter has exercises, almost like six pillars. It has not artistic technique building exercises, but flow inducing exercises, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was really beneficial for me as a teenager. And a lot of the lessons in that book are still things that sort of roll around in my head and are helpful for me. And so I've been thinking I'm going to revisit that book.
Yeah, it's interesting. You said the expression you used, going to war with your inner critic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever read The War of Art?
No.
It's a book by Stephen Pressfield. I believe he was a screenwriter, and I read it quickly. And that's like the central first theme in the book, the concept of resistance, how to identify it and how to address it. So I think it's just interesting that multiple people who've written on the subject have tried to explore that. I think that's, you know, what we were talking about with, why people are so willing to give up so quickly, right? That critic is just too loud.
There's this voice in their head that tells them that everything they do is crap. And I've learned that, like, a lot of the time I can put out crap. Like, there are mistakes in Survivor Max that are blaringly obvious to me as problems.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't notice them. And for some people, they become their favorite scenes, right? The critic is so self-absorbed. Like, you don't even really necessarily know what you're producing that's going to click with another person, right? And so it's a prejudgment to have this critic tell you that what you're doing is no good for them, right?
yeah, for somebody else. And it's interesting, too, it's that what I realized is that anything I do, I'm going to toss it around and wrestle with it so much more than anybody who takes it in.
Yeah, you're looking at it in a completely different resolution than everyone else.
So if I made even something like a podcast, I have this hyper awareness of everything that I don't like about it. But it's also because I've run through it four or five different times in four or five different ways. Now, the opposite, you know, here's the trouble. You know, the opposite is I might put something out and say, dang, did I nail that? And somebody else could say, no, that really sucked. You really blew it. You know?
Yeah.
So I think there's a healthy process of self-critique and that I'm still exploring. But if people get hung up there, and I think this is what's really stressed in the war of art, they're going to be doomed. They're never going to move forward. And it's really, really important to wage a war with that voice. But first to know that enemy, where it comes from and what it's trying to do.
Something that that helped me in this department was to go out and see how imperfect things are behind the scenes. And this occurred in two places, really, as far as how it impacted me. One was to go to Star Trek conventions and to see props that are like, here's the actual prop of the phaser from Star Trek The Next Generation. And you get up close to it and it's like a piece of wood and the brush strokes are really obvious. But on the screen, because it's far away, because it's on film, it looks shiny and metal and futuristic.
Right.
And so that gave me a sense of the margin for error. Right. And the other one is beauty magazines. You can find them online now, but I was briefly involved with a magazine in Marin County where I did, I guess, an editorial on how much Photoshop goes into a magazine image, right? And you juxtapose the like post-polishing perfect fashion glamour shot with the original photograph of the real woman mm-hmm. and how different they are, right? And this gives you a sense of how distorted perfection is. And that lets you let go of it, I hope, or help me let go of it.
Yeah, see, I guess it depends on how you come to think about these things and who the influences are. You're right. When you think about seeing the Star Trek gun at the Star Trek convention, and upon close examination, how unimpressive it actually is. Yeah, yeah. You're right. This huge margin of error, acceptable error, does emerge. Yeah. I remember, on the other hand, watching this documentary about the film Raging Bull. Martin Scorsese movie came out in 1980. Allegedly, he ordered the reshoot of a scene. The movie is about a boxer named Jake LaMotta. It takes place mostly in the 40s and the 50s. He ordered a reshoot of the scene because a guy in the fourth row was wearing a watch that wasn't period. A guy in the fourth row of the boxing match, and somehow this was identified. So I said, that's what goes into the finished product. Now, obviously, that's extreme. The best place is probably somewhere in the middle of the crappy Star Trek gun and the reshooting of the scene because the guy has the wrong watch on. My point is, depending on who your influences are, the need for perfection could be dramatically different.
Yeah.
Final question. Of everything you've created in your artistic life, what would you say is your favorite, or what is your greatest accomplishment?
Wow. I mean, it depends on your standard. The thing that comes to mind is, I mean, a lot of people don't even know that I did this. this was in, it must have been 2003. I hosted a funeral for myself. Huh. And I built a coffin out of plywood, and I staged the scene with things that were meaningful to me, and I invited people, and I put out unpublished stories and poems out on tables for people to read and grade. There were red pens there for people to grade them. And it was a party, the theme of which was I just died, and I spent the party in the coffin, and I had two friends give eulogies. It was a whole performance piece, right? And it was a rebirth for me too at the time. Yeah, as far as like raw, even intimate, creative juice.
Yeah.
I would say that and some of the other events I hosted at that location.
What inspired you to do it?
There's this notion. I don't know if this is science or not. but there's two notions. One is that supposedly every 7 years your body has cycled through all of its cells and you're actually physically a whole new person for any cell that is going to regenerate and replace itself. Maybe it's just skin. I don't know. This is a factoid. It's probably not even true.
I have heard that with that exact number 7 years before too. So right. I will check it before we go to print on this.
The other one is, and I heard this from a therapist when I was younger, that every 7 years there's a psychological cycle and that a person has sort of cycled through an entire psyche and has become a whole new person, learned so much that they're different than the person that they were 7 years ago.
Indeed, yeah.
And so there's this reoccurrence of the notion of 7 years. There's a lot of stuff about seven in Kabbalah and Gnosticism, stuff like that. That's obviously not science. But I had this notion that, well, if my body is all new and my psyche is all new, then I must be a whole new person. than I was 7 years ago. And so I ought to start having funerals for these people.
What's interesting is you were like fairly young when you did that, right? You probably weren't even 30.
Must have been 21.
Yeah.
But I'm 35 next year, so I'm thinking about doing this again. but I like this idea of death and rebirth as a sort of constant theme in all of my artwork. Mm-hmm. That like my senior project in college, like you get your sort of last semester to put together a whole performance that is the, you know, the punctuation mark at the end of your college career. And mine was an art burn. I was tired of producing. And so I was ready to destroy. And so I did a gallery of all of my portfolio from college, and I said, whatever doesn't sell, I'm going to burn. And it was about the lack of permanence. Like, people in the art field want you to use archival materials, and they want you to use sort of spray fixatives and put things behind glass so that they'll last forever. But the fact of the matter is that none of it lasts forever. Like, maybe it outlasts you,
yeah,
if you're lucky. But like,
right,
even if you are immortal, we're still going to suffer the heat death of the sun. So like, there is no permanence. And so I felt I needed to destroy my portfolio and to show that destruction was as creative a force as creation, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. In the future, you can probably do something similar, but you can shoot all the stuff that you don't want into space.
Yeah. Well, it's already in space. So
that's true. Done. Well, that's a fine way to finish. I really appreciate you joining this conversation. As I said to you before you started, it was like six people. Once I started asking for guest suggestions for this month, six people said Davi Barker. So I'm glad you had the time to do it. And of course, I'm looking forward to seeing you again in June as you make your way out here. That will be very cool. Maybe we can have some kind of recreation of last year's event.
Yeah, for sure.
So for people in my audience, where can they see your work or even maybe purchase some of your output?
Well, for zombie stuff, it's survivormax.com. For merchandise, it's shinybadges.com. For all the Bitcoin stuff, it's bitcoinnotbombs.com. And then if you just go to davibarker.com, there's a sort of directory.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Davi. It was great to talk to you as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. You just say a person's name and then tell a fact about where they live.
Hey, everybody. Somebody sent me a message on MySpace and asked if we're not doing new subscriber geography trivia anymore because there haven't been any this month. And I wanted to address that concern because there's probably a lot of people who are waiting for their new subscriber geography trivias. I'm very, very grateful that we've had a number of signups this month. I think more than 10 already, and that is super. Just to let you know, those can take like 45 minutes to an hour each, and I think it is totally worth it to be able to publicly thank the people who support this show. I just haven't had the time to do it this month. I got a bit of a late start. I've got some other projects going on, and I just couldn't free up, you know, 7 to 10 hours in the latter half of the month to take care of that. So it will return next month. We will have more new subscriber geography trivias because you live in a place and there's facts about it. And you support this show, maybe. Maybe you don't yet. But you can go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and sign up. Some recent additions. Oh boy, a bonus show with Mark Edge from Free Talk Live, Ellen Ball, and me talking about the state of the Free State Project. That's a hot topic right now. And of course, the Podcast Masters Debates Special Election Edition, Make America Great Again, question mark. Later this month, I'll be adding a cool roundtable that I did with Richard Grove and Kevin Cole. But there's hundreds of hours of stuff in there. So support the show, get extra content. Well, I mean, we're making plenty of content, but that's a reason in itself to support the show. So I appreciate if you can do it. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. All right, cool. Thanks so much. Talk to you again soon.